Blog Talk Radio.
Enough to be able to grasp the
theme. But what I guess what I'm getting at is, but this tonight, I've always been a fan of Jack London, and years and years I've enjoyed his work when I was in my teens and 20s. And I had an old book here that I got way back a long time ago with some of his short stories. And I was looking for something to read tonight, and I came across this really remarkable short story. And it's funny because it's not, I mean, some people probably know it, I'm sure, if they know Jack London, but I, for some reason, never ran across this one. It's not as famous as To Build a Fire or, you know, The Wildlife or, you know, Pearls of Parley. You know, that kind of thing. And, of course, his novels were very famous, too, in Call of the Wild. But I wanted to say that, it's a wonderful story, and it's appropriate for people of any time. But, well, let me begin. A piece of steak. With the last morsel of bread, Tom King wiped his plate clean of the last particle of flour, gravy, and chewed the resulting mouthful in a slow and meditative way. When he rose from the table, he was oppressed by the feeling that he was distinctly hungry. Yet he alone had eaten. The two children in the other room had been sent early to bed in order that in sleep they might forget that they had gone supperless. His wife had touched nothing and had sat silently and watched him with solicitous eyes. As she was a thin, worn woman of the working class, though signs of an earlier prettiness were not wanting in her face. The flour for the gravy she had borrowed from the neighbor across the hall, and the last two halfpennies had gone to buy the bread. She sat down by the window on a rickety chair that protested under his weight, and quite mechanically, he put his pipe in his mouth and dipped into the side pocket of his coat. The absence of any tobacco made him aware of his action, and with a scowl his forgetfulness, he put the pipe away. His movements were slow, almost hulking, as though he were burdened by the heavy weight of his muscles. He was a solid-bodied, stolid-looking man, and his appearance did not suffer from being over prepossessing. His rough clothes were old and slouchy. The uppers of his shoes were too weak to carry the heavy resoling that was itself of no recent date. And his cotton shirt, a cheap two-shilling affair, showed a frayed collar and ineradicable paint stains. But it was Tom King's face that advertised him unmistakably for what he was. He was the face of a typical prizefighter, of one who had put in long years of service in the square ring and by that means developed and emphasized all the marks of the fighting beast. It was distinctly a lowered countenance, and that no feature of it might escape notice. It was clean-shaven. The lips were shapeless and constituted a mouth harsh to excess. It was like a gash in his face. The jaw was aggressive, brutal, heavy. The eyes, slow of movement and heavy-lidded, were almost expressionless under the shaggy, indrawn brows. Sheer animal that he was, the eyes were the most animal-like feature about him. They were sleepy, non-lion-like, the eyes of a fighting animal. The forehead slanted quickly back to the hair, which clipped close, showed every bump of a villainous-looking head. A nose twice broken and molded variously by countless blows, and a cauliflower ear, permanently swollen and distorted to twice its size, completed its adornment, while the beard, fresh shaven as it was, sprouted in the skin and gave the face a blue-black stain. Although it was the face of a man to be afraid of in a dark alley or lonely place, and yet Tom King was not a criminal, nor had he ever done anything criminal, outside of brawls, common to his walk in life. He was harmed, yet he had hardened no one. Nor had he even been known to pick a quarrel. He was a professional, and all the fighting brutishness of him was reserved for his professional appearances. Outside the ring, he was slow-going, easy-natured, and in his younger days, when money was flush, too open-handed for his own good. And he bore no grudges and had few enemies. And fighting was a business with him. And in the ring, he struck to hurt, struck to maim, struck to destroy, and there was no animus in it. It was a plain business proposition. Audience assembled and paid for the spectacle of men knocking each other out. The winner took the big end of the purse. And when Tom King faced the Woolloomooloo Gouger 20 years before, he knew that the Gouger's jaw was only 4 months healed from after having been broken in a Newcastle bout. And he was played for that jaw and broken it again in the ninth round. Not because he bore the Gouger any ill will, but because that was the surest way to put the Gouger out in the win. The big end of the purse. Nor had the Gouger borne him any ill will for it. It was the game, and Boar knew, and both knew the game and played it. Tom King had never been a talker, and he sat at the window, more morosely silent, staring at his hands. A vein stood out in the back of the hand, as large and swollen, and the knuckles smashed and battered and malformed, testified to the use to which they had been put. And he had never heard that a man's life was the life of his arteries, but well he knew the meaning of those big upstanding veins. That heart had pumped too much blood through them at top pressure, and he no longer did the work. He had stretched the elasticity out of them, and with their distension had passed his endurance. He tired easily now. No longer could he do a fast 20 pounds hammer and tongs, fight, more gong to gong, with fierce rally on top of fierce rally, beaten to the ropes and in turn beating his opponent to the ropes and rallying fierce and fastest of all in that last 20th round. With the house on his feet and yelling, himself rushing, striking, ducking, raining showers of blows upon showers of blows and receiving showers of blows in return, and all the time the heart faithfully pumping and surging blood through the adequate veins. The veins swollen at the time had always shrunk down again, though not quite, each time imperceptibly at first, remaining just a trifle larger than before. He stared at them and at his battered knuckles, and for the moment caught a vision of the youthful excellence of those hands before the first knuckles had been smashed on the head of Benny Jones, otherwise known as the Welsh Terror. The impression of his hunger came back on him. Blimey, but could I go a piece of steak? He muttered aloud, punching his huge fist and putting out a smothered oath. I tried both Burke's and Solly's, his wife said half apologetically, and they wouldn't, he demanded. Not a penny, Burke said, she faltered. Go on, what'd he say? As Hal was thinking Sandal, I'd do you tonight, and how your score was comfortable, big as it was. Tom King grunted, but did not reply. He was busy thinking of the bull terrier he had kept in his younger days, to which he had fed steaks without end. and Burke would have given him credit for 1,000 stakes then. The time had changed. The town was getting old, and old men fighting before second-rate clubs couldn't expect to run bills of any size with this tradesman. They had got up in the morning with a longing for a piece of steak. The longing had not been abated. He had not had a fair training for his fight. For this fight, it was a thought year. It was a drought year in Australia. Times were hard, and even the most irregular work was difficult to find. And he had had no sparring partner, and his food has not been of the best, nor always sufficient. And he had done a few days Navy work when he could get it. And he had run around the domain in the early mornings to get his legs in shape. But it was hard training without a partner and with a wife and two kiddies that must be fed. And credit with the tradesman and undergone very slight expansion when he was snatched with Sindel. The secretary of Gaiety Club had advanced him 3 pounds, the loser's end of the purse, and beyond that had refused to go. Now and again, he had managed to borrow a few shillings from old pals who would have lent more, only that it was a drought year, and they were hard put themselves. No, and there was no use in disguising the fact that training had not been satisfactory. He should have had better food and no worries. Besides, when a man is 40, it is harder to get into condition than when he is 20. "What time is it, Lizzie?" he asked. His wife went across the hall to inquire and came back 8:15. "They'll be starting the first bout in a few minutes," he said. "Only a tryout. Then there's a 4-round spar between Dealer Wells and Fridley, and a 10-round to go between Starlight and some sailor bloke. I don't come on for over an hour." At the end of another silent 10 minutes, he rose to his feet. "Truth is, Lizzie, I ain't had proper training." He reached for his hat and started for the door. He did not offer to kiss her. He never did on going out. But on this night, she dared to kiss him, throwing her arms around him and compelling him to bend down to her face. And she looked quite small against the massive bulk of the man. "Good luck, Tom," she said. "You gotta do him." I gotta do him," he repeated. "That's all there is to it. I just gotta do him." He laughed with an attempt at heartiness while she pressed more closely against him, and across her shoulders he looked around the bare room. It was all he had in the world, with its rent overdue and her and the kiddies, and he was leaving it to go out tonight to get meat for his mate and cubs. Not while a modern working man going to his machine grind, but in the old primitive royal animal way, by fighting for it. "I gotta do him," he repeated. This time I hint desperation in his voice. "If it's a win, it's 30 quid, and I can pay all that and so on. But a lump of money ain't left over. If it's a lose, I get not even a penny for me to ride home on the train. The secretaries give all that it's coming from a loser's end. Goodbye, old woman. I'll come straight home if it's a win. I'll be waiting up," she called him along the hall. It was a full 2 miles to the Gaiety, and he had walked along. He remembered how, in his palmy days, he had once been the heavyweight champion of New South Wales, who would have ridden in a cab to the fight. And how, most likely, some heavy backer would have paid for the cab and ridden with him. There was Tommy Burns. There were Tommy Burns and that Yankee Jack Johnson. They rode about in motor cars, and he walked. And as any man knew, a hard 2 miles was not the best preliminary to a fight. He was an old Un, and the world did not wag well with old Uns, with old Uns. He was good for nothing now except Navy work, and his broken nose and swollen ear were against him even in that. He found himself wishing that he had learned a trade. It would have been better in the long run, but no one had told him, and he knew deep down in his heart that he would not have listened if they had. It had been so easy. Big money, sharp, glorious fights, periods of rest and loafing in between, a following of eager flatterers, the slaps on the back, the shakes of the hand, the toff glad to buy him a drink for the privilege of a five-minute talk, and the glory of it in the yelling houses, the whirlwind finish, the referees, kings, king wins, and his names in the sports columns next day. Those had been times when he realized now, in his slow, remunerating way, that it was the old ones he had been putting away. He was young, rising, and they were age sinking. Now, no wonder it had been easy. They, with their swollen veins and battered knuckles and weary in the bones of them from the long battles they had already fought. And he remembered the times he had put out old Stoucher Bill at Rush Cutter's Bay in 18th round, and how old Bill had cried afterward in the dressing room like a baby. Perhaps old Bill's rent had been overdue. Perhaps he had at home a missus and a couple of kiddies. And perhaps Bill, that very day of the fight, had had a hungering for a piece of steak. And Bill had fought game and taken incredible punishment. He could see now, after he had gone through the mill himself, that Stoucher Bill had fought for a bigger stake that night 20 years ago than had young Tom King, who had fought for glory and easy money. No wonder Stoucher Bill had cried afterward in the dressing room. Well, a man had only so many fights in him to begin with. It was the iron law of the game. One man might have 100 hard fights in him, another man only 20, each according to the make of him and the quantity of his fiber, had a definite number, and when he had fought them, he was done. Yes, he had had more fights in him than most of them, and he had had more, far more than his share of the hard, grueling fights, kind that worked the heart and the lungs to bursting, that took the elastic out of the arteries and made hard knots of muscles out of youth's sleek suppleness, that wore out nerves and stamina and made brains and bones weary from excessive effort and endurance overwrought. Yes, he had done better than all of them. There was none of his old fighting partners left. He was the last of the old guard. He had seen them all finish, and he had had a hand in finishing some of them. They had tried him out against the old ones, and one after another, he had put them away, laughing when they, old Bill, Stoller Bill, they cried in the dressing room. And now he was an old un, and then tried out the youngsters on him. There was the bloke Sandal. He had come over from New Zealand with a record behind him. But nobody in Australia knew anything about him, so they put him up against old Tom King. And if Sandal had been made it for showing, he would be given better men to fight and bigger purses to win. So it was to be depended upon that he would put up a fierce battle. He had everything to win by it, money and glory and career, and Tom King was the grizzled old chopping block that guarded the highway to fame and fortune. And he had nothing to win except 30 quid to pay to the landlord and the tradesman. And as Tom King thus ruinated, there came to his stolid vision the form of youth. Glorious youth, rising, exultant and invincible, supple of muscle and silken of skin and heart and lungs that had never been tired and torn and that laughed at limitations of effort. Yes, youth was the nemesis. He destroyed the old ones and wrecked not that. In so doing, it destroyed itself. It enlarged its arteries and smashed its knuckles and were in torn. It was in turn destroyed by youth, for youth was ever youthful. It was only age that grew old. At Castlereagh Street, he turned to the left, and three blocks along came to the Gaiety. A crowd of young larkins hanging outside the door made respectful way for him, and he heard one say to the other, "That's him. That's Tom King." Inside on the way to his dressing room, he encountered the secretary, a keen-eyed, shrewd-faced young man, who shook his hand. "How you feeling, Tom?" he asked. "Fit as a fiddle, King," he answered, though he knew that he lied and that if he had quit, he would give it right there for a good piece of steak. And when he emerged from the dressing room, his seconds behind him, and came down the aisle to the squared ring in the center of the hall, a burst of greeting and applause went up from a waiting crowd. He acknowledged salutations right and left, though few of the faces did he know, and most of them were the faces of kiddies unborn when he was winning the first laurels in the square ring. He leaped lightly to the raised platform and ducked through the ropes to his corner, where he sat down on a folding stool. And Jack Ball, the referee, came over and shook his hand. And Ball was a broken-down pugilist who, for over 10 years, had not entered the ring as a principal. King was glad that he had him for a referee. They were both old ones, and he should rough it with Sandal a bit beyond the rules, and he knew Ball could be dependent upon to the passing-by. Aspiring young heavyweights, one after another, were climbing into the ring and being presented to the audience by the referee. Also, he issued their challenges for them. Young Pronto Bill, announced from North Sydney, challenges the winner for £50 side bet. And the audience applauded and applauded again as Sandal himself sprang through the ropes and sat down in his corner. And Tom King looked across the ring at him curiously, for in a few minutes they would be locked together in merciless combat, each trying with all the force of him to knock the other into unconsciousness. But little could he see, for Sandal, like himself, had trousers and sweater on over his ring costume. His face was strongly handsome, crowned with a curly mop of yellow hair, while his thick, muscular neck hinted at bodily magnificence. Young Pronto went to one corner and then to the other, shaking hands with the principals and dropping down out of the ring. Challenges went on. And ever young climbed through the ropes, youth unknown but insatiable, crying out to mankind that with strength and skill it would match issues with the winner. A few years before, in his own heyday of invincibleness, Tom King would have been amused and bored by these preliminaries. But now he sat fascinated, unable to shake the vision of youth from his eyes. Always were these youngsters rising up in the boxing game, springing through the ropes and shouting their defiance, and always were the old ones going down before them. And they climbed to success over the bodies of the old, and ever there came more and more youngsters, youth unquenchable and irresistible, and ever they put the old ones away, themselves becoming old ones and traveling the same downward path, while behind them, ever pressing on them, was youth eternal, their new babies, grown lusty and dragging their elders down, and behind them, more babies to the end of time, youth that must have its will and that will never die. glanced over to the press box and nodded to Morgan of the Sportsman and Colbert of the Referee. Then he held out his hands, while Sid Sullivan and Charlie Bates, his second, slipped on his gloves and laced them tight, closely watched by one of Sandal's seconds, who first examined critically the tapes on King's knuckles. A second of his own was in Sandal's corner, performing a like office. Sandal's trousers were pulled up, and as he stood up, his sweater was skinned off over his head, and Tom King looking saw youth incarnate, deep-chested, heavy-thrown, and muscles that were slipped and slid like live things under the white satin skin. The whole body was acrawl with life, and Tom King knew that it was a life that had never oozed its freshness out from the aching pores during the long fights wherein youth paid its toll and departed not quite so young as when it entered. The two men advanced to each other, and as the gong sounded and the seconds clattered out of the ring with the folding stools, they shook hands and instantly took their fighting attitudes. And instantly, like a mechanism of steel and springs balanced on a hair trigger, Sandal was in and out and in again, landing a left to the eyes, a right to the ribs, ducking a counter, dancing lightly away the dancing, menacing back again. He was swift and clever. It was a dazzling exhibition. The house yelled its approbation. But King was not dazzled. He had fought too many fights and too many youngsters, and he knew the blows for what they were, too quick and too deft to be dangerous. Evidently, Sandal was going to rush things from the start. He was to be expected. It was the way of youth, expending its splendor and excellence in wild insurgence and furious onslaught, overwhelming opposition with its own unlimited glory of strength and desire. Sandal was in and out, here, there, and everywhere, light-footed and eager-hearted, a living wonder of white flesh and stinging muscle that wove itself into a dazzling fabric of attack, slipping and leaping like a flying shuttle from action to action through a thousand actions, all of them centered upon the destruction of Tom King, who stood between him and fortune. Tom King patiently endured. He knew his business. He knew youth now that youth was no longer his. There was nothing to do till the other had lost some of his steam, was his thought, and he grinned to himself, and he deliberately ducked so as to receive a heavy blow on the top of his head. It was a wicked thing to do, yet eminently fair, according to the rules of the boxing game. A man was supposed to take care of his own knuckles, and if he insisted on hitting an opponent on the top of the head, he did so at his own peril. And King could have ducked lower and let the blow whiz harmlessly past, but he remembered his own early fights and how he smashed his first knuckle on the head of the Welsh Terror, and he was but playing the game. The duck had accounted for one of Satchel's knuckles. Not that Sandal would mind it now. He would go on, superbly regardless, hitting as hard as ever throughout the fight. But later on, when his long ring battles had begun to tell, he would regret that knuckle and would back and remember how he had smashed it on Tom King's head. And the first round was all Sandal, and he had the house yelling, and the rapidity of his whirlwind rushes. He overwhelmed King with avalanches of punches, and King did nothing. He never struck once, contenting himself with covering up, blocking and ducking and clinching to avoid punishment. And he occasionally fainted when the weight of a punch landed and moved solidly about, never leaping, or springing or wasting an ounce of strength. Sandal must foam the froth of youth away before discreet age would dare to retaliate. All King's movements were slow, methodical, and his heavy-lidded, slow-moving eyes gave him the appearance of being half asleep or dazed. Yet they were eyes that saw everything, that had been trained to see everything, though all his 20 years and odd in the ring, and they were eyes that did not blink or waver before an impending blow, but that coolly saw and measured distance. And seated in his corner, for the minute's rest at the time, at the end of the round, he lay back with an outstretched legs, his arms resting on the right angle of the ropes, and his chest and abdomen heaving frankly and deeply as he gulped down the air, driven by the towels of his seconds. And he listened with closed eyes to the voice of the house. "Why don't he fight, Tom?" Many were crying. "He ain't afraid of him, are ya?" Muscle-bound, he heard a man on a front seat comment. "He can't move quicker. 2-1 on Sandel and quits." The gong struck and the two men advanced from their corners. Sandel came forward fully three-quarters of the distance, eager to begin again, but King was content to advance the shorter distance. It was in line with his policy of economy. He had not been well trained, and he had not had enough to eat, and every step counted. And besides, he had already walked 2 miles to the ringside. It was a repetition of the first round, and Sindel attacking like a whirlwind, and with the audience indignantly demanding why King did not fight, beyond fencing and several blows delivered and ineffectual blows, he did nothing but say block and stall and clinch. Sandel waited to make the pace fast, while King, out of his wisdom, refused to accommodate him, and he grinned with a certain wistful pathos in his ring-battered countenance, and went on cherishing his strength with the jealousy of which only age is capable. And Sandel was youth, and he threw his strength away with the munificent abandon of youth. And to King belonged the ring generalship, the wisdom bred of long aching fights. And he watched with cool eyes and head, moving slowly and waiting for Sandel's froth to foam away. To the majority of the onlookers, it seemed as though King was hopelessly outclassed, and they voiced their opinion in offers of 3-1 on Sandel. But there were wise ones, who knew King of old time, and who covered what they considered easy money. The third round began as usual. One-sided, with Sandel doing all the leading and delivering and all the punishment. A half minute had passed when Sandel, overconfident, left an opening. King's eyes and right arm flashed in the same instant. It was this first real blow, a hook with a twisted arc of the arm to make it rigid, and with all the weight of the half-pivoted body behind it, it was like a sleepy-seeming lion suddenly thrusting out a lightning paw, and Sandel caught it on the side of the jaw and fell like a bullock. And the audience gasped and murmured awestruck in applause, and the man was not muscle-bound, after all, and he could drive a blow like a deep trip hammer. Sandel was shaken. He rolled over and attempted to rise, but the sharp yells from his seconds to take the count restrained him. He knelt on one knee, ready to rise, and waited while the referee stood over him, counting the seconds loudly to his ear. In the ninth, he rose in fighting attitude, and King facing him. He knew regret that the blow had been an inch nearer the point of the jaw. It would have been a knockout, and he could have carried the 30 quid home to the missus and the kiddies. And the round continued to the end of its 3 minutes, and Sandel, for the first time respectful of his opponent and King, slow of movement and sleepy eye as ever. As the round neared its close, King warned of the fact by sight of the seconds crouching outside, suddenly outside, ready for the spring and through the ropes, worked the fight around to his own corner. And when the gong struck, he sat down immediately on the waiting stool while Sandel had to walk across the diagonal of the square to his own corner. It was a little thing, but it was the sum of little things that counted. Sandel was compelled to walk that many more steps, to give up that much energy, and to lose a part of the precious minute of rest. At the beginning of every round, King loafed slowly out from his corner, forcing his opponent to advance the greater advance. The end of every round fought the fight maneuvered by King into his own corner so that he could immediately sit down. And two more rounds went by, in which King was parsimonious of effort and Sandel prodigal, and the latter's attempt to force a fast pace made King uncomfortable, for a fair percentage of the multitudinous blows showered upon him went home. Yet King persisted in his dogged slowness, despite the crying of the young hotheads for him to go in and fight. And again, in the sixth round, Sandel was careless. Again, Tom King, fearful, right, flashed out to the jaw, and again Sandel took the 9-second count. By the second round, Sandel's tink of condition was gone, and he settled down to what he knew was to be the hardest fight in his experience. Tom King was an olden, but a better olden than he had ever encountered, and an olden who never lost his head, who was remarkably able at defense, and whose blows had the impact of a knotted club, and who had a knockout in either hand. And nevertheless, Tom King dared not hit often. He never forgot his battered knuckles, and he knew that every hit must count if the knuckles were to last out the fight. And he sat in his corner, glancing across at his opponent. The thought came to him that the sum of his wisdom and Sandel's youth could constitute a world championship heavyweight. But that was the trouble. Sandel would never become a world champion. He lacked the wisdom, and the only way for him to get it was to buy it with youth. And when the wisdom was his, youth would have been spent by buying it. King took every advantage he knew. He never missed an opportunity to clinch, and in effecting most of the clinches, his shoulder drove stiffly into the other's ribs. And in the philosophy of the ring, a shoulder was as good as a punch so far as damage was concerned, and a great deal better so far as concerned expenditure of effort. Also in the clinches, King rested his weight on his opponent and was loath to let go. This compelled the interference of the referee, who tore them apart, always assisted by Sandel, who had not yet learned to rest. He could not refrain from using those glorious flying arms and writhing muscles of his, and when the other rushed into a clinch, a sticking shoulder against rib and with head resting against Sandel's left arm, Sandel almost invariably swung his right behind his own back and into the projecting face. It was a clever stroke, much admired by the audience, but it was not dangerous and was, therefore, just that much wasted strength. But Sandel was tireless and unaware of limitations, and King grinned and doggedly endured. Sandel developed a fierce right to the body that made it appear that King was taking an enormous amount of punishment, and it was only the old ringsters who appreciated the deft touch of King's left glove to the other bicep just before the impact of the blow. It was true, the blow landed each time, but each time it was robbed of its power by that touch on the biceps. And in the ninth round, three times inside a minute, King's right hook hit twisted arc to the jaw, and three times Sandel's body, heavy as it was leveled to the mat. And each time he took the 9 seconds allowed him, and rose to his feet, shaken and jarred, but still strong. He had lost much of his speed, and he wasted less effort. He was fighting grimly, but he continued to draw upon his chief asset, which was youth. And King's chief asset was experience. And his vitality had dimmed, and his vigor abated, and he had replaced them with cunning, with wisdom born of the long fights, and with the careful shepherding of strength. Not alone had he learned never to make a superfluous movement, but he had learned how to seduce an opponent into throwing his strength away. And again, by feint of foot and hand and body, he continued to inveigle Sandal into leaping back, ducking, or countering. And King rested, but he never permitted Sandal to rest. It was the strategy of age. And early in the 10th round, King began stopping the other's rushes and straight lefts to the face, and Sandal, grown wary, responded by drawing the left, then by ducking it and delivering his right in a swinging hook to the side of the head. It was too high up to be vitally effective, but when first it landed, King knew the old, familiar descent of the black veil of the unconscious across his mind for the slightest fraction of an instant, he ceased, and in one moment he saw his opponent ducking out of his field of vision and the background of white, watching faces, and the next moment he again saw the opponent and the background of faces. It was as if he had slept for a time and just opened his eyes again, and had slept for, and yet the interval of unconsciousness was so microscopically short that there had been no time for him to fall. And the audience saw him totter and his knees give, and then saw him recover and tuck his chin deeper into the shelter of his left shoulder. And several times Sandal repeated the blow, keeping King partially dazed, and then the latter worked out his defense, which was also a counter, and feinting with his left, he took a half step backwards at the same time, uppercutting with the whole strength of his right so acutely was it timed that it landed squarely on Sindel's face in the full downward sweep of the duck, and Sandal lifted in the air and curled backward, striking the mat on his head and shoulders. Twice King achieved this, then turned loose and hammered his opponent to the ropes. He gave Sandal no chance to rest or to set himself, but smashed blow in upon blow till the house rose to its feet and the air was filled with unbroken roar of applause. But Sandal's strength and endurance were superb, and he continued to stay on his feet. A knockout seemed certain, and a captain of police, appalled at the dreadful punishment, arose at the ringside to stop the fight. And the gong struck for the end of the round, and Sandal staggered to his corner, protesting to the captain that he was strong and sound. And to prove it, he threw two black air springs, and the police captain gave in. Tom King, leaning back in his corner and breathing hard, was disappointed. If the fight had been stopped, that referee, perforce, would have rendered him the decision, and the purse would have been his. Unlike Sandal, he was not fighting for glory or career, but for 30 quid. And now Sandal would recuperate in the minute of rest. Youth will be served, this saying flashed into King's mind. He remembered the first time he had heard it, the time when he had put away Stosher Bill. The tough, who had brought him to a drink after the fight and patted him on the shoulder, had used those words. Youth will be served. The tough was right, and on that night in the long ago, he had been youth, and tonight youth sat in the opposite corner. As for himself, he had been fighting for half an hour now, and he was an old man. He had fought like Sandal. He would not have lasted 15 minutes. But the point was that he did not recuperate. those upstanding arteries and the sorely tried heart would not enable him to gather strength in the intervals between the rounds, and he had not had sufficient strength in him to begin with. His legs were heavy under him and beginning to cramp. He should not have walked those 2 miles to the fight, and there was a stake which had got up longing for that morning. A great and terrible hatred rose up in him for the butchers who had refused him credit. It was hard for an old man to go into a fight without enough to eat, and a piece of steak was such a little thing, a few pennies at best, yet it meant 30 quid to him. With the gong that opened the 11th round, Sandel rushed, making a show of freshness, which he did not really possess. King knew it, for that it was a bluff, as old as the game itself, and he clinched to save himself. Then growing free allowed Sandel to get set. This was what King desired. He feinted with his left and drew the answering duck and swinging upward hook, then made the half step backwards, delivered the uppercut full to the face, and crumpled Sandel over the mat. After that, he never let him rest, receiving punishment himself by inflicting far more, smashing Sandel to the ropes, hooking and driving all manner of blows into him, tearing away from his clinches or punching him out of attempted clinches, and ever when Sandel would have fallen, catching him with one uplifting hand and with the other immediately smashing him into the ropes where he could not fall. The house by this time had gone mad, and it was his house, nearly every voice yelling, "Go it, Tom, give him, give it, get him," and "You've got him, Tom, you've got him," and it was to be a whirlwind finish, and that was what a ringside audience paid to see. And Tom King, who for half an hour had conserved his strength, now spended it prodigally in the one great effort he knew he had in him. It was this one chance now, or not at all. His strength was waning fast, and his hope was that before the last of it ebbed out of him, he would have beaten his opponent down to the count. And as he continued to strike and force, coolly estimating the weight of his blows and the quality of the damage wrought, he realized how hard a man Sandel was to knock out. And stamina and endurance were his to an extreme degree, and they were the virgin stamina and the endurance of youth. Sandel was certainly a coming man. He had it in him. Only out of such rugged fiber were successful fighters fashioned. Sandel was reeling and staggering, but Tom King's legs were cramping and his knuckles going back on him. Yet he steeled himself to strike the fierce blows. Every one of them brought anguish to his tortured hand. Though now he was receiving practically no punishment, he was weakening as rapidly as the others. His blows went home, but there was no longer the weight behind him, and each blow was the result of a severe effort of will, and his legs were like lead, and they dragged visibly under him, while Sandel's backers, cheered by his symptom, began calling encouragement to their man. And King was spurred to a burst of effort, and he delivered 2 blows in succession, a left and a trifle too high to the solar plexus, and a right cross to the jaw. They were not heavy blows, yet so weak and dazed was Sandel that they went down and lay quivering. The referee stood over him, shouting the count of the fatal seconds in his ear. If before the 10th second was called, he did not rise, the fight was lost. The house stood in hushed silence. King rested on trembling legs. A mortal dizziness was upon him, and before his eyes and sea of face sagged and swayed, while to his ears, as from a remote distance, came the count of the referee. Yet he looked upon the fight as his. It was impossible that a man so punished could rise. And only youth could rise. sandal rose. At the fourth second, he rolled over on his face and groped blindly for the ropes. By the seventh second, he had dragged himself to his knee. Then he rested his head, rolling groggily on his shoulders, as the referee cried, "Nine!" And Sandal stood up, right in proper stalling position, his left arm wrapped around his face, his right wrapped around his stomach. Thus were his vital points guarded. And while he lurched forward toward King in the hope of effectively effecting a clinch and gaining more time, at the instant Sandal rose, King was at him, but the two blows he delivered were muffed by the stalled arms, and next movement Sandal was in the clinch and holding on desperately while the referee strove to drag the two men apart, and King helped to force himself free. He knew the rapidity with which Youth recovered, and he knew that Sandal was his if he could prevent that recovery. One stiff punch would do it. Sandal was his, indubitably his. He had out-generaled him, out-fought him, out-pointed him. Sandal reeled out of the clinch, balanced on the hairline he between defeat and survival. One good blow would topple him over and down and out, and Tom King, in a flash of bitterness, remembered the piece of steak and wished that he had it behind that necessary punch he must deliver. And he nerved himself for the blow, but it was not heavy enough nor swift enough, and Sandal swayed but did not fall, and staggering back to the ropes and holding on, King staggered after him, and with a pang like that of dissolution, delivered another blow, but his body had deserted him. All that was left of him was a fighting intelligence that was dimmed and clouded from exhaustion. The blow that was aimed from the jaw struck low, higher, no higher than the shoulder, and he had willed the blow higher, but the tired muscles had not been able to obey. And from the impact of the blow, Tom King himself reeled back and nearly fell. And once again he strove. This time his punch missed together, and from the absolute weakness, he fell against Sandal and clinched, holding on to him to save himself from sinking to the floor. King did not attempt to free himself. He had shot his bolt. He was gone. And Youth had been served. Even in the clinch, he could feel Sandal growing stronger up against him. And when the referee thrust them apart, there before his eyes, he saw Youth recuperate. From instant to instant, Sandal grew stronger. His punches, weak and futile at first, became stiff and accurate. Tom King's bleared eyes saw the gloved fist drive at his jaw, and he willed to guard it by interposing his arm. And he saw the danger, willed the act, but the arm was too heavy. It seemed burdened with a hundredweight of lead. It would not lift itself, and he strove to lift it with his soul. And then the gloved fist landed home. He experienced a sharp snap that was like an electric spark, and simultaneously the veil of blackness enveloped him. When he opened his eyes again, he was in his corner, and he heard the yelling of the audience like the roar of the surf of Bondi Beach. And a wet sponge had been pressed against the base of his brain, and Sid Culver was blowing cold water in a refreshing spray over his face and chest. His gloves had already been removed, and Sandal, bending over him, was shaking his hand, and he bore no ill will toward the man who had put him out, and he returned the grip with a heartiness that made his battered knuckles protest. Then Sandal stepped to the center of the ring, and the audience hushed its pandemonium to hear him accept young Pronto's challenge and offer an increased size of the bet to 100 pounds. King looked on apathetically while the second mopped the steaming water from him, dried his face, and prepared him to leave the ring. He felt hungry. It was not the ordinary gnawing kind, but a great faintness, a palpitation at the pit of the stomach. remembered back into the fight to the moment when he had Sandel swaying and tottering on the hairline balance of defeat. Ah, that piece of steak would have been done it. He had lacked just that for the decisive blow, and he had lost. It was all because of the piece of steak. His seconds were half supporting him as they helped him through the ropes. He tore free from them, ducked through the ropes unaided, and lay and leaped heavily on the floor, following on his heels as he forced the passage for him down. As they forced the passage for him down the crowded center aisle, leaving the dressing room for the street and the entrance to the hall, some young fellow spoke to him. "Why didn't you go in and get him when you had him?" the young fellow added. "Ah, go to hell," said Tom King, and passed down the steps to the sidewalk. The doors of the public house at the corner were swinging wide, and he saw the lights and the smiling barmaid's head, heard the many voices discussing the fight and the prosperous chink of money on the bar. Somebody called to him to have a drink, and he hesitated perceptibly, then refused and went on his way. He had not a copper in his pocket, and the two-mile walk home seemed very long. He was certainly getting old. Crossing the domain, he sat down suddenly on a bench, unnerved by the thought of the missus sitting up for him, waiting to learn the outcome of the fight. It was harder than any knockout, and it seemed almost impossible to face. He felt weak and sore, and the pain of his smashed knuckles warned him that even if he could find a job at Navy work, it would be a week before he could grip a pick, handle, or shovel. The hunger or palpitation at the pit of his stomach was sickening. His wretchedness overwhelmed him, and into his eyes came an unwanted moisture. He covered his face with his hands, and as he cried, he remembered Stokes or Bill, and how he had served him that night long ago. Poor old Stosher Bill. He could understand now why Bill had cried in the dressing room. And that was A Piece of Steak by Jack London. And it's a story that is so well written, and it's exciting to read because it's so well written. But you're right in there with the fight. You feel every blow. You feel every minute. You know, every second. And that's great writing. And you know, it's a great story. Great story. And it makes us all wonder about our own age, how wasteful we are in youth, how much we give away, how much we waste our energy to our minds, you know. And fighters to some extent. It's not quite as brutal. I hope you enjoyed the program tonight. I hope you enjoyed that article if you ever heard it before. You've heard it now. And now look up Jack London and look up some of his great works, and a lot of his short stories are fantastic. I'd like to read some more of them for you in the future. But that particular one was Jack London's A Piece of Steak. And I hope you all have a good night, and we'll talk to you next week.